but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Well, of all the sites that held NCAA tournament action over the weekend, I contend that the action in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania was probably the most dramatic, including the legend of Jack Golke and Oakland University in the state of Michigan. I've got some friends in Michigan, so I did know that Oakland was in Michigan, but it's always fun when the collective basketball verse discovers that together, that Oakland University is in Michigan and not the Bay Area. But what a run Oakland had and nearly made it to the Sweet 16. And, of course, your Oregon Ducks come back home after bowing out in double OT to Creighton over the weekend in a game that started brutally late out there. It was late out here on the West Coast. I can't imagine what it was like covering that out on the East Coast, but Will Graves did it. He writes for the Associated Press. Judah Newby and Stephen Vaughn joining you on the Bald-Faced Truth, and he joins us on the show now. That Oregon-Creighton game Saturday night, did that tip after 10 o'clock local time out there, Will?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know what the scheduling decisions were made. I mean, how does a game in Salt Lake start at 10:30 local time in the morning and then a game in Pittsburgh start after 10 p.m. local time at night? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me, but it was a late one. I mean, this gig makes you stay up late, but I think I got home at 2:30. Which is, I'm an old man. I'm a middle-aged old man. And it was a rough one. But, I mean, the thing about it is, like, to your point, the games were I guess we had six games here all weekend, and four of them were, you know, right down to the end, classic sort of, you know, March Madness type stuff. So, yeah, so your adrenaline's going, and you get home at 3, and you still can't go to sleep, right? But the tournament, you know, it is a reminder of what makes the tournament special. And, you know, it was a thrill to watch.
The atmosphere on TV looked really cool, and obviously the drama of the games helped in that. But what was it like inside the arena in Pittsburgh? The atmosphere and the crowd that came out to see the action.
Well, you know, it's Pittsburgh isn't a basketball town per se, not to the level like Portland where it could sustain an NBA team. It just doesn't have that. I mean, Pitt has been, you know, off and on pretty good for most of the last 25 years, but even they struggle to fill their arena when they're not playing a blue blood. I mean, and their arena only seats 12-5. So, I love hoops, right? So for the arena to be packed for, you know, all three sessions, and, you know, Greg Campy, the great coach at Oakland, you know, he nailed it on Wednesday when he was talking. He said, look, I know how our game's going to go. If we get it tight, if it's tight late, you know, there's going to be like 4,000, 5,000 Kentucky fans there, and there's going to be 1,000 Oakland fans there, and there's going to be 12,000 people that have no idea where Oakland is, and they're going to be pulling for Oakland in that last minute. And that is exactly what happened. It's sort of the vibe through, you know, especially on Saturday. I mean, the Wednesday night game, the Thursday night game when they beat UK was electric. And I think it was even at a higher level on Saturday when Oakland really showed that what they had done on Thursday wasn't a joke, right? It wasn't like a fluke. It wasn't just a one-off. So it was thrilling. Yeah, and it was one of those things where, you know, I think I texted somebody with about 30 seconds to go in regulation, and I was like, this is one of those things, as a fan, I want there to be something super dramatic that happens. But as somebody on deadline, like, if there's some last-second shot that's going to live for eternity in NCAA history and I have to write something that matches that, I don't know if I have the juice for that. Unfortunately, we didn't get any last second. I mean, we got overtime games. Unfortunately, once they got to the extra period, second extra period for the Ducks game, both games sort of got out of hand. But really fun, and you know, I needed a jolt. You know, kind of the doldrums here. Baseball starts up here in a couple of weeks. Football season's over. hockey team here isn't doing so hot, and I cover all of them. I wanted something to kind of, you know, spruce me up a little bit, and watching the tournament certainly did that.
What were the vibes feeling for John Calipari after losing that game with the fans there? You talked about it, you know, a bunch of Kentucky fans, and then the rest of the fan base, the rest of the arena just rooting for Oakland. Calipari, if he gets bought out, $35 million. What was the vibes like in there? Because it just seemed like when he walked off the court, he was just another season, another early bow out, and it just seemed like the fans were going to be all over him. Was it kind of a weird sense in there after that game?
Well, I covered Kentucky earlier in my career before I came to Pittsburgh for the AP. I worked in Louisville for 6 years and sort of overlapped. The end of my tenure there was at the beginning of Cal, so I covered Cal the first 2 years when they were electric, and he brings in John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins and all these NBA guys, and the program immediately kickstarts. But it's been 9 years now since they've gotten to a Final Four. When Tubby Smith left in 2007, it had been 9 years since they had been to a Final Four. Now, Tubby left voluntarily. You know, he decided, you know what, this is a headache. I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to go to Minnesota and, you know, have some sanity restored to my life. UK and Cal didn't have that options because nobody's going to pay Cal what he's making at UK, and UK is not sure they can afford that buyout. I do remember sort of vividly watching after DQ Moore for Oakland hit that corner three to put him up four with whatever it was, 30 seconds left. And I don't want to say sealed it, but it certainly felt like that was the dagger. You could see the UK fans just sort of stand up. And, like, the thing is, it wasn't disbelief. The look on their face was not disbelief. It was more disgust. And the reason it wasn't disbelief is because this has become a thing now, right? Like, they haven't made it out of the first weekend since 2019, which for that job, that is an awfully, awfully, awfully long time. But I think, you know, I think UK, you know, still have some connections there. My sense is that, you know, they'll probably run it back. He's got a great, he's got a great recruiting class coming in, as he always does, right? And the thing is, if you come up with a $34 million to buy him out, then you have to go and hire another guy. And you have to hire another guy and probably pay him at least $5 to $6 million. And this guy's going to want some level of job security because you literally just filled a guy who fired, you know, not fired a guy that wins all the time, but doesn't win quite enough. And who wants that job? Right? I mean, it is a blue blood program, trust me. And but I covered that when Tubby left in 07, you know, and they thought UK kind of, where UK was actually at and where they thought they were at were two different things. So they went after Billy Donovan and he said no. And they went after Jay Wright and he said no. And they went after Rick Barnes and he said no. And that's how you end up hiring Billy Gillespie at 3 a.m, you know, in Mitch Barnhart's basement. Because you're panicking because you're Kentucky. And, oh, my God, we can't have our job open forever. We're Kentucky. People should, you know, want to walk, crawl over each other to get here. And that wasn't the case. And I wonder if it's a similar – it's not apples to apples, but it's apples to lemons maybe. It's still a fruit. Like, so there are some similarities to kind of where they were at when Tubby left and where Cal is at. I just think, you know, the financial circumstances – and Cal's prideful too, you know. But I will say this. You know, I asked him on Thursday. He talked to, he's from the area. He's from about maybe 20 minutes north of Pittsburgh. He talked about his blue-collar roots, and, you know, which is all true, and how he kind of was a hard-scrabble guy, and how he got his first job. Really, his first big break was Kansas and Pitt in the 80s. His blue-collar work ethic, all that stuff. And then I said, Cal, how hard is it to instill that blue-collar work ethic in your guys when – you know, you have the best of everything at Kentucky. You know, I mean, some of these guys, when they go to the NBA, it's a step down. Like, and that's a testament to how Kentucky takes care of their players. And Cal's response was, my guys make a lot of money in the NBA. That was his response. And I was like, what does that, you know? And then, you know, and he said, I'm not sure I answered your question. I said, that's okay, but I'm used to it. But, like, that's telling of his mindset, right? And that maybe, you know, but, like, so I remember, you know, after – his first year when John Wall and Eric Bledsoe and DeMarcus Cousins and I'm missing one player, all got picked in the first round. He called it the greatest night in the history of Kentucky basketball. That is, I mean, you know, his job is to win games, not to develop guys for the NBA. It happens. It's great for him if both happen, but, like, that fan base does not care that those guys go on to have success in the ABA. They do not care. I mean, they root for them and whatever, but it's not the same, you know.
Right.
And so I wonder if, he keeps kind of running it back. For some reason, the plan to win with young guys, which worked his first 6-7 years there, doesn't work so much anymore, and it's going to be probably a long, hard offseason for UK.
We're talking to Will Graves, writes for the Associated Press, based in Pittsburgh. He was covering the action this weekend, some of the crazy first and second round action out in Pittsburgh. Now, the way that Kentucky went down was at the hands of one young man named Jack Golkey in Oakland. This guy's a living legend now, Will. I mean, that's just part of the beauty of the tournament, right? And I know being based in Pittsburgh, like, you'll get regional action, you'll get first and second round action every now and then, but it's got to be fun. It's got to add a little bit of spice to your coverage when you get this walking legend like Jack Golkey coming to the arena, and four halves later, everybody knows his name because he's taken down Kentucky and taken NC State to overtime.
You know, I mentioned I needed a jolt, right? Well, so I covered that game on Thursday night, and then I ended up covering the second game, the NC State Texas Tech game. I get home, 2:30. My kid gets up for high school at 6, and I basically beat him up. I was so jazzed, right? And I actually spent the morning, at 6:30 in the morning, I sat down on my computer, and I sent notes to Jack's high school coach, and I sent Jack notes to the two coaches that he had at Hillsdale, the small D2 school that he was at before he got to Oakland. And all three of those guys emailed me back within an hour. And then I ended up talking to them each for about half an hour, just kind of getting a portrait of who this kid is. And look, I mean, anybody that ever played pickup ball with me knows I love to let it fly. My favorite play is the number one play. Get the ball to me and it's going up, right? And to watch him, give the freedom to do that. And, his coach has told me, he's like, "Will, those shots look crazy to you, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, kind of." Just because of the way, it's not like he wasn't getting guarded. There were hands in his face. There were guys bumping him. There were hands on his back. He was coming off flares. He was coming off screens. He was spotting up. He was pulling up, on the run. And they talked about literally how the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours that kid had gone through his whole life. I mean, his high school coach had coached him since Jack was in the fourth grade. And he was like, "Well, this kid is the same kid. He's literally the same kid. He's taking the same shots, except now he makes them, right? As opposed to when he was in fourth grade." And, you got all of those stories, right? He was at Hillsdale for 5 years. And they literally, he had that sixth COVID year. He wanted to stay there, but he got his undergrad in accounting, and they don't have a postgraduate degree there in business. They don't. He literally had no options. He could not stay. And he still went to the head coach, who's now the athletic director there, and the assistant coach, who's now the head coach, and basically asked for permission to leave. And they were like, "Jack, why are you asking us? Like, you can do what you want, man. You've been here 5 years. You've given your, a quarter of your life to this university. Why are you asking us permission?" That is just the kind of kid he is. And to see him sort of enjoy it, I filed a story on him on Friday at like 5:30. And I was like, I think he had his merch line on his T-shirts to come out. And by like 8 o'clock, he had a TurboTax thing that he had picked, an NIL thing that he had picked up, right? I got an email last night that Buffalo Wild Wings has signed him to a deal. I mean, like, that's the, and it's one of those things where, like, it's so unexpected, right? It's not like these guys, these big time schools who come into the spotlight and get lured to these schools by these big offers. I mean, this was very organic, right? It just sort of happened. It's what happens when you drop 10 threes on Kentucky in the tourney, right? And it was a thrill. It was a reminder. His college coach said, "There's something pure about Jack." And, I don't want to sink this guy up, but I mean, like, I think when he got here on Wednesday, if you told him what was going to happen by Saturday night, he probably wouldn't have believed you, right? So there is a purity in the unexpectedness of it. And that, like, I'm 50 years old. I've covered a lot of stuff. I cover the Steelers. I deal with a lot of guys that can be headaches. I mean, my God, I covered Antonio Brown for 7 years. Like, to have something like that was just very, very refreshing.
Speaking of unexpected, here in Oregon, we weren't expecting much of the Ducks going into the Pac-12 tournament. They make that run. They get to the NCAA tournament. And then they go to Pittsburgh, and They beat South Carolina. Jermaine Cousinard scores 40 and Folly Dante dominant both ends. And then that Creighton game goes to double overtime. Just what was that like? And is Creighton a real team in this tournament? Because I feel like in that whole region, you could argue that Cousinard and Dante were the two best players in the entire game, entire region of that bracket. And the Ducks couldn't pull away because they just didn't have any other help. Just what was the sense of that with Altman going against Creighton and his old team with the Ducks in round two there?
Yeah, I mean, I've never, you know, I'm talking here about Jack Golke. I have never seen anything quite like that, the energy that he brought. But what Jermaine and the Folly did in that second game on Saturday, where they literally were the entire offense in the second half in overtime, I've never seen that. I mean, it was remarkable. And Dante, considering the health struggles that he's gone through this year, like he was going against the three-time Big East Defensive Player of the Year, Kalkbrenner, and he held his own. I mean, you almost, you know, it's kind of funny, like when you, and look, obviously I'm based in Pittsburgh. It's not like I'm following the Ducks for year round, so I'm just kind of getting a feel for, you know, in the short time I'm around them, I'm trying to get a feel for the program. So when I write about them, I'm coming from a place of some knowledge, right? And, like, it's unfortunate the way the regulation ended. I mean, to not take a free throw the entire game and then the first one be one that consulted with, 30 seconds left, you know, with a guy that's had a dominant game but is a 60% free throw shooter, for have him to miss it, and then everything that sort of transpired after that, like, you don't want that, you know, like, that's, you know, you want somebody to win the game. And let me be clear, Creighton definitely won the game in overtime, but I think Oregon was in the perfect spot, and we consider what Dante and Cousinard did to get them to that spot, for him to be, you know, play a small role, but a pivotal role in sort of how it, getting away from them. You know, that's how the tournament goes sometimes. But it was tough. A lot of respect for the way that those two guys gutted it out. I think Shelstad, you know, not being 100% certainly was a problem. But yeah, it just to go 2-on-5 and take, you know, a top 10 team to overtime in the tournament, in the second round of the tournament, was pretty impressive.
Last thing for you, Will. We're talking to Will Graves, Associated Press, based in Pittsburgh, was covering all the action out there. Also covers the Steelers. So we got a bit of a side eye here in the Pacific Northwest still on Russell Wilson. Just, you know, out of curiosity at the very least, maybe with a bit of a smile on our faces if we're Seahawk fans. But I saw Mike Tomlin said that Russ is in pole position to be the starter in Pittsburgh over the newly acquired Justin Fields. What do you make of that whole situation as the offseason continues to go on and the draft gets closer? What are the Steelers looking at QB?
Well, I mean, I've covered this team for this. I think I just finished my 12th or 13th season. I started in 2011. Do the math. I don't know what it is, 12 or 13. And I've gotten, and you know, I know these guys pretty well. I know Mike T fairly well. Their GM Omar Khan is a good dude. Took over 2 years ago for Kevin Colbert, and like they have a Steeler way, right? Like there's the Steeler way. We're stable. We don't do anything rash. We don't make any big moves. We just draft our guys and develop them, and then we try to find guys that sort of fall through the cracks on the free agency market. We don't try to sign guys that make a ton of money or have high profiles. That's not what they do. And yet they have, you know, after you don't win a playoff game, you know, I'm talking about Kentucky not going to the Final Four in 9 years. Well, Steelers haven't won a playoff game since 2016. That's an awful long time. They've got the same coach, and they have, to their credit, decided, you know, we're going to mix things up. Whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. But considering the lengths that they had gone to sort of defend and support Kenny Pickett during both of his seasons in Pittsburgh, particularly the second one where there was this pattern where he would not play great and the offense would not be great, but they would win games, right? But then, you know, he goes out, Mitch Trubisky comes in, they lose a couple, and then Mason Rudolph comes in, they fire the offensive coordinator, all of a sudden they're putting up yards, putting up points, and you're like, what's going on here? So it's a new dawn here, it's a new era. They have decided to sort of change their model. Getting to Russell Wilson's, it didn't make any sense to me. I don't know if it still makes sense. I mean, it makes sense to me because it's cheap, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can get a guy with a Super Bowl ring for $1.2 million to play the most important position on the field, you do that. Is it going to work? I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you have to be – I'm in such awe. I don't know if awe is the right word, but I'm sort of marveling at how they got these guys on the cheap, right? I mean, to have the Broncos pick up $38 million of that salary and to get, you know, to get Fields, a guy that was a top 10 pick for a conditional sixth rounder, like, that's – but it's one of those things where, like, if you there's something you want, whether it's a computer or a car or whatever. You can't afford it, and then you find it on sale at 98% off, and you're not sure it works, and you're not sure you need it at this point in your life, but you just can't help yourself because it's so cheap, right? You're like, oh my God, I can get this thing that I wanted, and I can get it a deal on it, and I think that's sort of what's happened here. I mean, I think they did realize that, you know, Kenny Pickett or Mason Rudolph, whoever it was going to be, was not going to get them to catch the Kansas Cities of the world, the Buffaloes of the world. So, you know, I've heard, like, I sent emails to guys in my company that have covered Russ, and I got mixed reviews. I'm not going to detail specifically what they said, and I'll be interested to see how Russ goes over in the locker room if it gets sideways. You know, like, that is like, if he – I just hear he's unique, for lack of a better word. And I don't know if that's what the Steelers needed, that position, but they decided that what they were getting from Kenny Pickett and the rest of that group was not what they needed. And so we'll see. I'm skeptical that it's going to work out in terms of them getting the success that they want, in terms of cat, you know, getting to an AFC title game or something like that. But it won't be boring, which for this team is actually a change of pace.
Change of pace indeed. Will Graves, Associated Press, based in Pittsburgh. Thanks for the time, Will. It was great to hear your insights with boots on the ground with all the college hoops action out there, and got to get a Steelers thought in there. So I appreciate that. Thanks for your time.
Take care, guys. Enjoy the tournament.
There he is, Will Graves. Pittsburgh was loaded with the drama, so it was fun to hear that. We'll break some of his thoughts down, plus Shohei Ohtani news coming up as well. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn on the Bold Faced Truth.